Hello, it's Thursday, March the 10th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Are you feeling fatigued, the odd stomachache, headache? You could have a condition called burnout. BT, a French businessman, has taken a 12% stake. The second largest shareholder is a German company. Are we about to lose another major company to overseas owners? The war over Lilibet. Harry and Meghan have now sent a legal letter to the BBC. Whatever next? NHS data, your data, it's being sold. Do you agree with that? But first, a diplomatic broadside from Joe Biden's head of diplomacy to Boris Johnson over Northern Ireland. That's how they started the G7 summit. Senior official in Joe Biden's administration, of course the president is here in Cornwall for the G7 summit, are trying to play down a rebuke to Boris Johnson, which suggested he had inflamed tensions in Northern Ireland in the so-called sausage war trade row with the EU. The US had allegedly strongly urged Britain to stay cool and reach an agreement. Crunch talks are taking place this weekend. I'm joined now by Sammy Wilson. He's the Democratic Unionist Party's Brexit spokesperson, and he's the MP for East Antrim. Sammy Wilson, pretty astonishing. The president flies in with a rare diplomatic rebuke to the British Prime Minister in the form of this written memo, which you wouldn't expect normally a traditional ally to send to an ally.
Yeah, I mean, a bit of a cheek, really, especially given how badly he's handled his own domestic affairs, not least the border between Mexico and the United States. And, of course, he has given the rebuke on the basis of clearly not having a clue what the issues are. He doesn't understand what the central principles of the Good Friday Agreement are. Otherwise, he would have recognised there's need for consent for the changes which the protocol brings about. And secondly, he doesn't understand what the implications of the protocol are either, because he would have, had he done that, he would have known the economic devastation which it's caused in Northern Ireland, the social unrest which it has caused in Northern Ireland, and the way in which it has undermined the very basis of the Good Friday Agreement in terms of separating Northern Ireland from the rest of the United Kingdom.
And the Northern Ireland Protocol, it's not just about trade, is it, Sammy? It's also about trying to ensure that peace remains in Northern Ireland. It's an important part of it, and it suggests compromise and diplomacy at all times. It doesn't appear there's been that much diplomacy and compromise, certainly I would say, on the part of the EU towards Britain about sausages and processed meat, for instance.
No, and in fact, the EU seem to be using the protocol as a battering ram against Britain. I mean, first of all, the protocol, we were told at the time that we warned against it and said it was always going to be a disaster, but we were told, it'll affect very few goods, because it's only those goods which are at risk of going into the Irish Republic, which will be subject to any checks. Of course, every good which comes into Northern Ireland, the EU are now insisting that there should be checks on. They've added to the list of goods, including now biscuits, if they have powdered milk in them. We now have a situation where the border between GB and Northern Ireland is more policed than the whole of the border between the EU and all of the eastern countries which border it, Russia, Belarus, and all of the other ones which are chief smuggling routes. In the last 3 months, there's actually been more checks on goods coming into Northern Ireland than what there have been along the entire eastern border of the EU, or indeed the checks of goods coming into Rotterdam, which is a gateway for the trade which EU has with the whole of the rest of the world. And I think that shows you how disproportionate this is and how, in fact, the EU have been breaking the terms of the protocol. And Britain's quite right to be angry about it and to refuse to accept the EU's interpretation of the protocol.
Is Britain guilty, though, as Lord Frost has suggested, hasn't he? They perhaps underestimated the impact of Brexit in Northern Ireland. I mean, quite why the European Union isn't prepared to accept British biscuits and British sausages going into Northern Ireland, which have been going in there for decades and decades. But did the British government, perhaps even, Sammy, knowing that there were going to be problems with Northern Ireland, still press ahead with this deal because they were determined to get Brexit done come what may?
Now, I don't put all of the fault at the door of the EU. The EU obviously saw an opportunity. They took that opportunity because they saw weakness on the part of the UK negotiators, and we're now left with the kind of deal which is disruptive not only to trade in Northern, between GB and Northern Ireland, disruptive to the UK internal market, but also has huge constitutional implications. Because don't forget, we are now, although we're part of the United Kingdom, we are now subject to EU laws in the future. Any change in EU law will apply to Northern Ireland, even though Northern Ireland representatives or UK representatives will have no say in that law, and that law will be administered and adjudicated on by the European Court of Justice. Now, it wasn't the government didn't know this was going to happen. I mean, I can remember speeches in the House of Commons where myself and Nigel Dodds highlighted this, and it was poo-pooed by the Prime Minister. In fact, at one stage he told businessmen in Northern Ireland, if you get any paperwork, you don't even have additional paperwork. See, if you do, put in the waste paper bin and ring me. It was dismissed in that blasé way. And, you know, I think that the government has culpability in all of this, and that's why it's important that they fix it.
So, just as the last question for you, Sammy, if you don't mind, how do they fix it? Do they have to scrap the protocol and start again?
Well, I think that the protocol needs to be scrapped because at its very essence, the protocol will set aside the use of the normal democratic means by which laws are made in Northern Ireland. Because don't forget, as a result of our membership of the Northern Ireland's membership of the single market, and that's basically where we are, about 60% of the laws which will govern manufacturing, agriculture, environment, working practices, etc. in Northern Ireland will be made in Brussels now, not at Westminster or not at Stormont, and there'll be no input from people in Northern Ireland to those laws. So, I mean, fundamentally, the protocol has to go, because as laws in the EU diverge from the rest of the United Kingdom, the checks on goods are just going to simply multiply. There is an alternative, of course, and the alternative is that we adopt the mutual enforcement of regulations solution, which has been put forward and has been well documented, and which the EU haven't actually been able to say why it wouldn't work, other than they don't want it, because they quite clearly they have the protocol, and they want to use the protocol, of course, not just to punish Britain, but to try and pull the United Kingdom back into the single market. Because if you notice, all of the solutions which they've put forward have been solutions along the lines, well, if you would align your veterinary rules, or if you would align this, that, and the other thing with us, then there wouldn't be a problem in Northern Ireland. So it's quite clear that the protocol is a Trojan horse to try and drag the United Kingdom back into a situation which we thought we'd broken free from when we had Brexit.
And remind me what that regulation is that you think the government could do, which the EU might resist.
Okay, well, the mutual recognition of standards would simply mean that rather than Northern Ireland having to adopt en bloc for everybody and every business, EU regulations, in other words, EU regulations, EU laws become part of the law in Northern Ireland, that only those companies which trade with the Irish Republic will be subject to having to meet with EU laws, regulations, tax obligations, etc. The UK government would agree that on its side, on our side of the border, that we would enforce those regulations so that companies, when they exported to the Irish Republic, for example, they would declare that they were abiding by all EU regulations, paying EU taxes, etc. If they were found that they weren't doing that, then the EU authorities wouldn't have to go to the trouble of pursuing them in another jurisdiction. The UK government would pursue them, and the penalties would be so severe that it would be a real disincentive for anybody to try and chance their arm and export into the EU without abiding by the regulations as they promised to do in their export declarations. Now, and equally, of course, on the EU side, on the Irish side, companies which were going to trade into Northern Ireland would be subject to the same rigour. And the benefits of this would be, first of all, there's a double check, because both the Irish authorities and the UK authorities would be in safeguarding. There'd be no need for border posts. And thirdly, Northern Ireland businesses which were not trading with the EU would not have to comply with EU regulations. So we maintain our sovereignty in that way. And I mean, the mutual enforcement of regulations and rules is one which has been put to the EU. They've never actually been able to say what's wrong with it, other than the protocol is there, so the protocol has to be maintained.
Very interesting. Maybe that's the answer, Sammy. That's Sammy Wilson, who's a Democratic Unionist Party Brexit spokesman, and he's also the MP for East Antrim. Thanks for joining us. So why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex have now launched a legal attack on an article published by the BBC, of all people, which claimed the couple did not ask the Queen if they could name their daughter Lilibet. The couple in their lawyer's letter said it is false and defamatory to suggest the monarch had never been asked if they could use her private nickname. Angela Levin joins me now. She's a royal biographer and, of course, she's the author of Harry, Conversation with the Prince. Angela, I never ever thought I would see a senior member of the royal family involved in litigation with the BBC, of all places, about their new child, their new baby. Astonishing.
It is astonishing, actually, and it's deeply depressing, and it makes me very angry, because they seem to be charged with anybody who says anything they don't like, out come the lawyers, and they're threatening lawsuits of all sorts of types. It is absolutely terrible. What I think is that we can't work this out absolutely, because they probably asked the Queen about it, but they didn't say the name. Harry has a former behaviour pattern when he wanted to get involved with Oprah Winfrey about mental health, and asked the Queen in 2019, when he was still a member of the royal family and much loved by the Queen, if he could do this programme because it would help Invictus Games people and ex-military servicemen and women who had been damaged. And she gave him permission. However, it wasn't quite the full picture. And the full picture involved him attacking his family. And I imagine that the same sort of thing has happened again. You know, can we use your name? And she was put on the spot, it seems, because it was done quite late, after the baby was born, it seems. And she was put in a spot. Now, what's interesting is that at 5:48 a.m., on the day that the child was born, they set up a domain, which was lilibetdiana.com. But they said that the birth happened at 11:40 a.m. So there's quite a few hours there. So they must have already decided that that's what they were going to do regardless. And the worry I have is that they are putting the Queen in a corner, trying to pull her down when she's just lost her husband. And today is would have been his 100th birthday.
Yeah, of course it would.
And make her so vulnerable. She doesn't like falling out with people in the family. And they don't want any staff there. Harry wants to have this private lunch with the Queen, and I hope he doesn't manage to manipulate her, because she must be vulnerable. You see how she walks now. She's more crunched over. She's getting older now, and it would be just terrible, because she can't have any control over the name. She could say to them, as she did indeed, you will lose your HRH titles if you use your royal position to indulge in commercial activities. Meghan was furious with this, but now it must be possible that they can use Lilibet Diana to have another, we've got the Archie Foundation, but to have another foundation, because I can't imagine Meghan not wanting the same for a daughter. She's a great feminist, as she's got for her son. And if they do that, they can get all sorts of commercial gains, which means the Queen is so unwillingly drawn into the Sussex behaviour pattern. It's terrifying and awful.
I must say, when I heard that they'd called the child the baby Lilibet. I thought that is a way of embedding the Queen in their lives for the rest of their lives and long after she's no longer with us, because she's already 95, because it was so much associated with Her Majesty.
Yes, absolutely. It's quite hard for the little girl because she is being set apart, of course. They're intruding on her privacy just as much as they had on Archie. And she will be known very differently as the great-granddaughter of Her Majesty the Queen, much loved in England, the Commonwealth and all around the world, hugely admired. So this little girl has got quite a heavy load on her back. And that's the second part. But I think that this is what they're doing. Sadly, I might be wrong, I hope I'm wrong, but they will draw her in, and it's, you know, if you told us we can't do it, now we can. How awful is that?
Yeah, I agree with you, Anja. And just to go back to where we started, the BBC have not taken this story down from their website. It ran on all the evening news bulletins. The correspondent, Johnny Diamond, said he'd been told by a palace source the Queen hadn't been asked about naming their daughter Lilibet. So they are clearly sticking to their guns. As every newspaper reports today, the palace have not denied it.
Yes. I mean, the royal commentator, editor of the BBC is a very experienced person. He's been working with the royals for a long time, and he can trust the people who tell him because they are very close to whichever royal they're talking about. And he hasn't stepped down and said, oh, sorry, I made a terrible mistake. And the BBC would not be supporting him because they've got enough trouble on their hands. Martin Bashir and Diana all that, and people don't like them anymore. And they would not stand by him unless they had strong evidence that what he's saying is true. I mean, good journalists are very careful about these sort of things. They don't rush ahead and do things hoping that they get it right. They have people who tell them.
Yeah, of course. And just finally, Harry said in a statement he's taking weeks or months of paternity leave. I'm not quite sure what he's taking leave from, but do you think perhaps he might give, if he is taking leave, just give it a rest now, stop talking to Oprah, stop talking to lawyers, and just spend some quality time with his wife and new child and stop causing trouble all the time?
Yes, I suspect that that's not what's going to happen. They're going to take 20 weeks, but you can bet absolutely that their team is going to carry on talking on their behalf. And this is how they work. I think they get very stimulated from being strong. And Meghan said they're doing this to lead by example. Now, that is the most extraordinary thing. Who are they? Who wants to follow them? There might be some followers, but actually, I think that nobody really wants to follow someone who shows no compassion, who goes around saying compassion is very important for those you know and those you don't know. But they're not compassionate, they're not caring. And I don't think they're leaders, although they think they do. And I think this is one of the problems they have, that they've always got to tell people because we're one above them. Although they want to live ordinary lives, they're not living ordinary lives, and they want to keep telling us what to do, whether it's not flying by car, whether it's being compassionate, whether it's taking out legal action against anyone who says something slightly wrong. I mean, it is, they're shockers, really.
I think they are. Good way to end it. That's Angela Levin, the author of Harry, Conversations with the Prince. Now, visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at mailplus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. The NHS is poised to share the personal data of millions of patients, probably your personal data, in fact. It's a move some claim will boost medical research, but others say it's raising important questions over privacy. NHS Digital has given every adult and child in England until June 23rd to opt out of the initiative. If you don't, your confidential data, or parts of it at least, will be shared with organisations requesting it for medical research or to help plan a more effective use of the NHS in future. I'm joined now by Good Health writer Pat Hagan, who's written authoritatively about this today. Pat, should I be concerned? I don't really think I want people knowing about my personal health data. Not that I've got anything particularly wrong with me, I think. I just feel a bit queasy about it. Should I feel queasy?
Yeah, that's how a lot of people feel. But the first thing to say, Andrew, is that within the last hour or so, the government has actually announced it's postponing the scheme until September.
Oh, interesting.
Because of the mounting concern over the use of the data. Now, that doesn't mean that it's saying, we were going to misuse data, but NHS Digital is kind of acknowledging that there hasn't been a proper consultation with the public, and it has been rushed through. So an extra 2 months to consult more widely with doctors' groups, patient groups, and all other interested parties. I think probably to do what they should have done in the first place, which is reassure people that there's nothing really underhand about this. And perhaps what most people don't realise, as we point out in our piece in the Mail today, is that their data has been used for decades without them, all for very good purposes for their own benefit. And millions of people are already on a research database, which has helped to develop some major medical breakthroughs. What the critics are saying is that this has been rushed through under the guise of the pandemic, without really thinking about how are people going to react to this when they find out. And it does look from the outside as if it's been bungled, essentially. It's not a bad idea, but it's been handled quite badly by those pushing it through. And hence, we now get this 2-month postponement to try and, settle people's nerves. But I understand that, people have been trying to opt out in their hundreds, if not thousands, in the last week or so, and contacting their GP surgeries to do so. Many GP surgeries are completely unaware of the program. They have no idea that this is even happening, or that they are expected to sign patients out of the scheme, originally within the next 2 weeks.
And you do wonder, I mean, I know NHS surgeries, doctor surgeries have got enough on their plate anyway, but I just thought it was quite surprising that my GP may have handed over this information without telling me. And my job, of course, to know what's going on. I've read about it in the papers, so I guess I could have called him up and said, are you doing this? But should GPs be asking patients if they want to do it, or is it up to us to say yay or nay?
This is where it gets murky and bogged down in legal terminology. But essentially, GPs are the kind of legal custodians of our medical records. But the data, they also have a legal obligation to supply NHS Digital with anonymized or unidentifiable data. So we're not saying hand over, every single detail, including name, address, and, every other aspect of a person's life. But they're caught between the devil and deep blue sea in a way. They have this responsibility to patients and the confidentiality of their relationship. But they're also kind of legally bound to supply anonymized data to NHS Digital for research purposes. And so that's what the people like the BMA and the RCGP are concerned about. What is this at risk of undermining the whole relationship between patients and their GPs? Because you can imagine, as a patient, that you're right, that's the question most people would ask. Why is my GP doing this and not even telling me? But it's really not a GP-led initiative. They're duty-bound, and you can argue it's the job of the government and NHS Digital to have a much broader, wider consultation process where they actually tell people what they plan to do with their data. And the history behind this, Andrew, is that a very similar scheme was, they tried to push it through back in 2013, 2014. It was called something else, but it did the same thing. And they got caught out for the same reasons, kind of lack of consultation, underlying concerns about who the data would go to and how it would be used, and whether patients could be identified. And those issues weren't properly addressed at the time, and they haven't been properly addressed this time.
And yet the other thing, Pat, that struck me, if they've been doing this for 30 years and handing over my information, why do they need another great big push now? Because haven't they got most of the information already?
No. So this is a massive expansion of what they already
have.
So the two main sets of data at the moment. So if you go into hospital and have a treatment for anything, it will be entered on a database called Hospital Episode Statistics. So they'll have a record of, you know, what people were treated for, what, and how they responded, etc. Separate to that, there is a database of general practice records. But it's only from, I think, about 480, 500 practices around the country are on a network that supply anonymized, completely anonymized, you can't identify the patients. They supply that to the government and also to other bodies, so it can be used for research. And that research, that database has been tremendously useful in, for example, you know, unlocking the mystery of the MMR vaccine and whether it really was the cause of autism. And it helped to establish that it wasn't. So it's tremendously useful. But that's only, you know, that's what a small percentage of the UK population. What this does is it extends that to literally everyone in England. All 55 million people in England would be on the database.
Right.
And that,
it's
what
fascinating.
That gives is a
yeah.
tremendous
yeah.
research resource.
Of course it
fantastic
does.
Research resource. But they forgot to tell the patients that they were going to do it.
They certainly did. Are we blaming Matt Hancock for this? We blamed him for a lot of other things, Pat. Can we blame him for this as well?
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, I don't know how far it goes up the chain.
He's the boss, I suppose, in the end.
Yeah, there have been various you know, groups and bodies involved in developing this. So I don't know that it's probably not. I don't think it's a good idea necessarily to just label this as a cock up and turn our backs on it, because done properly, you could see there are tremendous advantages to this. And we've come through a pandemic where access to data has been absolutely crucial in order to monitor people who need shielding, tracking the course of the disease and developing vaccines. This is a good idea, but it just hasn't been handled very well.
Well, Pat, you've dispelled my doubts. I was feeling queasy about it. Now I don't. So that's good news. Perhaps they need you, Pat, sorting this out for them, the government.
I don't think so. I'm sure they can do better.
Well, I don't know about that. That's the good health writer, Pat Hagan. Thanks for joining us. Well, it's time now for our regular city update with, of course, Ruth Sunderland, who's business editor at the Daily Mail. Ruth, a French Israeli billionaire, he's taken a £2 billion or 12% stake in BT. Is that another British company going to be sold overseas?
Well, you know, we have to hope it isn't the prelude to that, Andrew. What's actually happened is this chap, Patrick Drahi, who has a company called Altice, he's a Franco-Israeli billionaire. He owns assets, including Sotheby's, but he's mainly a telecoms investor. He's got telephone networks all around Europe and in the US and Israel as well. So he's taken this stake in BT. He's saying he doesn't actually want to take it over, but what he thinks he can do is to help BT in its big push towards fibre. And BT, as you know, has got hugely ambitious targets of supplying fibre to 25 million British homes by 2025. And that's not easy and it's not cheap. So that'll cost about £3 billion a year, and that's around half of BT's underlying profits. So it clearly is going to need a bit of a push with all of that. Now, if we take him at face value, you know, it could actually be quite good, because I think we all want the telecoms infrastructure to be completely up to speed. That's important for our growth. But Mr. Drahi does have a bit of a reputation for having a lot of debt, for being quite a gung-ho cost cutter. So these are characteristics that he would have in common with private equity investors. It is a concern. We need to see the cut of his jib, really, and see exactly what he does do. At the moment, I think we have to hope for the best. BT has been quite sluggish in making headway on all of this. So maybe he'll give them a kick up the pants. It does raise the question as well, why do we need somebody from outside to do this? Where are the British pension funds here? Why aren't we doing it for ourselves?
I know, and I know he says he's not interested in acquiring BT, but he would say that, wouldn't he? And we just can't have another crown jewel going overseas. Look what's happened with Heathrow Airport, all those sort of companies, Ruth. It's just not acceptable anymore, is it?
It would be awful. And what we mustn't forget is that BT was one of the flagships for shareholder democracy in the UK. Big part of the Thatcherite privatisation programme. Still has a lot of small investors who bought shares.
Me, one of them.
There you are, you see. And, you know, wouldn't it be a tragic irony if one of the companies that was meant to promote a shareholder democracy and give people a tangible stake in British infrastructure and the UK economy and corporate Britain, wouldn't it be just a tragic irony if that were to be, you know, to fall into foreign hands or to be dismantled, or, you know, it would just be terrible.
Mrs. Thatcher would be spinning in her grave, Ruth, I'm telling you.
Absolutely, absolutely right. Interestingly, the second largest shareholder now, after Mr. Draghi, is Deutsche Telekom.
Oh.
So, of all things. So I think what we really need is, you know, telecoms and communications are hugely important.
Absolutely
for
right.
rebuilding the economy post-Brexit, post-COVID. And, you know, we need to get on top of this ourselves. We can't sell the pass yet again with one of our key industries. We really can't.
I quite agree, as ever. That's Ruth Sunderland, business editor at the Daily Mail, with a pretty worrying story, I think, about what's happening at BT. So, more and more of us are suffering from burnout in the wake of the pandemic. That's according to the wellness expert, Penny Weston. Penny runs the Maid Wellness Centre in Staffordshire, and she says the number of people visiting the club suffering from burnout has tripled in the wake of the pandemic. So what is burnout? Well, it's a state of emotional, physical and mental exhaustion, often caused by stress over a prolonged period of time. Penny joins me now. Penny, you might think during the pandemic that people would be much less stressed because often they've been working from home, they haven't had to grapple with public transport, traffic congestion, that sort of thing, and it may have suited them to be working from home. But from your figures, the reverse is true.
Yes, that's correct. What I've found with our members is you've got the parents that have had to juggle both homeschooling and all that kind of side of things. But what I found with nearly everybody, so no matter their age or whether they're male or female, they're just exhausted from the constant anxiety of the pandemic, being told what they can and can't do, trying to keep up with it, and just being in a really stressful time. So it's not just the tangible things, it's just the overall pandemic effect, I guess.
Yeah, now, burnout is, as we said, it's a state of emotional, physical, maybe mental exhaustion. It's not a diagnosable psychological disorder, Penny, yet, but do you think it's something that ought to be?
I think so. I mean, at the end of the day, anything that can be diagnosed so that people can get treatment and or recommendations for self-care and doctor's advice is obviously a really positive thing. I mean, when we speak to our members at our wellness centre, often they don't feel like they can go to the doctor for these kinds of feelings and anxieties.
And some of it, I guess it's the headaches which come and go, stomach aches, lack of energy, feeling tired constantly. If people have those symptoms, what should they do about it? How would you then suggest they get themselves out of that bad place?
Well, I think in terms of the various symptoms, we obviously recommend exercise, and we're sort of a close-knit community, so we have wellness workshops where people can talk about these sorts of things. We don't advertise that we're a treatment centre, but we do like to help people where we can, and we are more of a proactive measure in terms of trying to get people into exercise, help their confidence, and you know, work together as a like a wellness community to try and support each other, really.
Mm. And when you tell people they've got burnout, how do they react?
I think a lot of people feel relieved sometimes because they're kind of thinking, yeah, you're right. Especially because with burnout, a lot of the symptoms manifest themselves physically, like you mentioned, with headaches and stomach aches and things like that. So they're automatically thinking of other ailments that aren't to do with stress and anxiety and burnout. They're thinking of, you know, digestive problems or other things. So it almost pieces everything together. And I think that sometimes understanding what burnout is and the sort of kind of a light bulb moment happens, and then that can almost help the situation as well, the fact that they know what it is.
Yeah, and you're saying also about exercise, Penny. There's lots of different options. You could take up trampolining, boxing, Zumba. Great friend of mine does Zumba. Freshwater swimming. And that literally does have a physical impact on the body, doesn't it? Because it releases chemicals which can improve your mood and reduce anxiety.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. I mean, I really couldn't advocate exercise enough, and I think it is so important, you know, to absolutely everybody. And like you say, there's such a wide range of options now. I think that depending on where you go to, you know, people used to be a little bit intimidated by gym environments, but there's so many options in studios and even at home, you know, solutions. So there's a lot of choice out there nowadays, like you say, from dancing to boxing to running to just vigorous walking, though, to be honest, really would help somebody's mood get that blood flowing,
Indeed. What's your favourite form of exercise, Penny?
Oh, gosh. So my favourite is actually HIIT training, which is just a really horrible, intense, quick, basically form of exercise, like an exercise class. So I prefer to kind of not have to spend too long doing it, and I'd rather it be short but as hard as possible. So that's my thing.
Short, sharp shock sort of treatment.
Absolutely, yes, yeah. And I honestly can't tell you how much, you know, more positive and sort of confident I feel afterwards. And the difference if I don't do that in the morning versus when I do is so kind of it's really obvious. So if people can find out what suits them and also the time of day that suits them to exercise, because mine is absolutely the morning because it sets me up for the day, you see.
Very good. All right, that's Penny Weston, who practices what she preaches, and she's from the Maid Wellness Centre in Staffordshire. Thanks for joining us. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, why don't you download the Mail Plus app? Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow, still with this wretched cold. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.